Hello, this is Scott Poley with the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. I'm here at the Information Security Summit in Cleveland, joined by Matt Scheer. Matt, can you kind of introduce yourself and explain your journey as far as how you got to where you are today, associated with cybersecurity in general?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here at the Information Security Summit and chatting with you. I guess it really started childhood and just sort of being fascinated with technology, and it wasn't quite the rage that it is today. Right. But when you grew up playing those early video game systems, for example, it would spark your interest in technology, and then reading in newspapers and stories and articles and seeing newscasts on people using technology in ways that the designers and the organizations, companies that built those technologies hadn't envisioned. And so that was fascinating to me as a kid, and just wanting to understand, how did they figure that out? That's brilliant. And so just regaled by these tales of technical wizardry in the early days of hacking and that sort of stuff. And then a movie like War Games comes out, and all of a sudden, wow, this is some cool stuff, right? And so for me, those were the early fascinations. I think when I was first growing up, I really wanted to be a game developer before that was really a big thing.
Similar boat as well, yeah.
Oh, yeah, nice. Yeah, and so, you know, I could actually name, like, some of the Activision programmers. These people were, you know, I would flip through the magazines and play the games, and you know, they were, like, my early rock stars, right?
Right.
And then growing up and just always still had that fascination and, you know, kind of hanging around Hacker Underground and just being well read on all this stuff and staying engaged, staying involved. To this day, I still read articles all the time. I'm always looking for topical things and things that are relevant today. And it, for me, it's just never quit because it's my passion.
Right. So what helped you break out into the field? Like, I can see, like, I was driven by the same curiosities that you described, right? But what was kind of the pivotal point that kind of got your, like, boots on the ground, feet wet in some of these things to get exactly where you landed today?
Sure. I think I really wanted to do security stuff before it was ever a career.
Right.
That was what fascinated me. Really, everything I was looking at doing was focused around a technology career and what that could be and what that would mean, and getting really interested in coding, which I used to do a long time ago.
Yeah.
Not quite as much these days, nowhere near as much these days, barely touch it. But in earlier years, yeah, I spent a lot of time doing that sort of stuff. And then systems administration, just got really interested in that kind of stuff. And then I can remember when networking started becoming quasi-affordable, and it was no longer just something that large businesses could do. And even with that, going, wow, I can't even afford a Lantastic license. So, ooh, what's this Interlink and InterServer command they built in the Microsoft DOS? And
right,
these null modem cables, and that was about as generic of a network as you could get, a couple systems tied together by serial cables running these commands. But I used it to help friends transfer files. We could play essentially LAN games like Doom and stuff like that through that null modem cable and play head to head. That was just fun. And so I think having that fascination with technology and knowing how these things worked, and then continuing to read and learn, know more about the Hacker Underground community and the topics that were very prevalent there, and a lot of those things like 2600 Magazine, Frack, eZine, those early resources that have been around since the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Just kind of rolled with it, and, you know, that's where it starts. And it's very hard to carve out, for example, a first systems administrator opportunity.
Yeah.
I heard no a lot, plenty of times along the way.
Yeah.
So you start off doing things like selling computers and then doing, like, side upgrades and hardware builds for people as kind of a side business just to make a few extra dollars. But honestly, it was less about the money and more about I'm getting better at what I do.
Yeah, it's like a passion thing, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then getting that experience working on help desks, and then getting the opportunity to work as a systems administrator and doing those things, based on the prior experience. Everything's sort of built on itself.
Right.
And then eventually, I couldn't believe it, but it took a long time that, for me, even harder than getting the first sysadmin gig, which was a monumental task, was getting the first information security focused job, where that was the core focus of the job. And I heard no plenty of times along the way, but I didn't stop. I just kept rolling with it. And once I finally got there, I heard no so many times for so long along the way that I'm never looking back. And so just off to the races, and have never stopped growing.
Yeah, so you mentioned help desk. That's something that I've always talked to individuals that want to get into the technology space in general. Because when I was in the military, I kind of played a side role when we wouldn't. I was technical. So, of course, if there anyone you know that's technical, just like when you have family members, hey, can you fix my computer? It's like a common thing. But that help desk type function is always great, because not only are you learning technology, but you're building those relationships and also like rapport, right? I remember if you're the guy that fixes something, people will remember you, and you're also the guy everyone calls all the time, right? So that's an interesting how you were able to tie kind of your passions and just like, you know, getting your feet wet on just helping people with technology in general as you're learning it. So you mentioned, you know, once you got into information security, you know, you're like, you weren't looking back. Now I can see that you, if I'm correct here, you're the VP of Computer Security and Incident Response. It's like a title. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So that's kind of a big, broad area. Can you kind of help dissect what does that kind of cover down on as far as where your areas of focus are within that? I know incident response is called out, but computer security could be a very broad topic.
Correct. So that really comes from the acronym CSIRT, Computer Security Incident Response Team.
Okay.
Which is really what I'm vice president of.
Okay.
And so the focus is really incident response. And we do a lot of DFIR, digital forensics and incident response. That's a huge part of the role. And that really covers quite a gambit. Now, that particular title is going to mean a lot of different things, a lot of different organizations. Right. With that officer title, I'm still very much hands on keyboard doing stuff all day long.
Yeah.
I'm not the only person doing that, but I spend a lot of time doing that. What I spend a lot of time doing, though, is helping coach and mentor others. We have our SOC analysts underneath the CSIRT team.
Okay.
And they are still learning. They are still building experience. I've been doing all this stuff long enough that I'm able to help guide them in what they're doing and learning, and taking time to explain things and walk them through things. Also, we have a lot of different, where I work is a large organization. Unfortunately, we get to do a lot of different things as far as coaching and mentoring.
Yeah.
So as far as that goes, I have tons and tons of opportunity, and I take advantage of those, because if I make the people under us better at what they do, we're getting less things that were just poorly worked or misunderstood. We start getting better, refined. This really is a potentially serious thing that
right.
that at the principal security engineer level, people need to look at and work on. And it's really about building a world-class SOC from that level on up into what we do on CSIRT.
Right.
And that's really the role. It's still handling major incidents if something looks like it was potential. And again, it could a breach could just be somebody got infected with malware on their one system.
Right.
And then we have to figure out what the scope of that is.
Right.
And triage things from there. And of course, we're properly isolating things that we highly suspect are likely compromised, all the way to as serious of a breach as you could imagine, like say a full-on ransomware outbreak.
Yeah,
this is not knock on wood, that hasn't happened in my role yet, but I have to be mentally prepared for that, because that's certainly within the realms of possibility.
All you have to do is read the news to know that.
I like how, you know, you described your journey and all the things you went through in your journey and how much you appreciate the journey you went on to be where you are today and the trials and tribulations. And then you talk about how you're mentoring and teaching people, and you get to kind of see their journey and see how they progress. And I think that's a very rewarding experience as well as making obviously your organization, your operations better. I think it's very rewarding to see people grow within this domain, because there's so many different things people can actually do and go to but there's also benefits that you see even with your own processes. So you do a lot of incident response type of investigations that come your way. And I know one of the big takeaways from incident response is kind of like your lessons learned. From your experience, what are some of the key lessons that you either find, you know, that you or the organization has learned time and time again, or things that are kind of top of mind when it comes to that?
Yeah, I think there's generally a couple things. There are the things that naturally happen because of real threats and real activities. And those are, I would much rather the other situation where somebody was testing something and found this. And we always hope to find these things, or the companies we contract with find these problems
right
before threat actors do
right
and exploit them. But then we have to investigate to determine, was this found before we found it, either internally or one of our partners found this particular vulnerability? And we have to treat everything as though it potentially was until we can find out that it wasn't. And it's very hard to prove negatives.
Yeah.
But we spend a lot of time doing that.
Right. And one of the things, so I currently in my career profession is specialized in threat hunting. So that's kind of what we do. And one of the values always compared to incident response is, you know, incident response, at least historically when I've worked in SOC operations, you know, one of the worst things you come across as you're doing an investigation and responding to incident is when you run out of visibility. You'll kind of follow the breadcrumbs and you hit some point where like, oh, we either don't have visibility because it was never set up to begin with, or we had a gap we just didn't know about. And with threat hunting, since it's proactive, we identify those things ahead of time, which is kind of like the value I always say is why you're looking at things proactively. So from an incident response perspective, if you're not dealing with incidents, you know, filling up your play, what are some of the activities you guys participate in other than incident response specific?
So I think we try to train. The SOC folks, we try to train up ourselves. We try to cross train everybody under us, one another.
Right.
Because you can't stop. If you're not a life learner,
right,
lifelong learner, if you don't love it, this may not be the best career path. I've given this joke many times for a number of years that information security is hard. I should have been an optometrist. And it's funny, but there's a, you know, grain of truth to that. If you have a passion for it, it's in my blood. There's not really much else I probably could do. Even though I joke about that, really I'm doing what I feel like I probably should be doing and kind of why I'm here and doing those type of things. But I think the other thing is when we're not on active incidents, documentation is, nobody likes doing documentation, but everybody loves having quality documentation. So you have to have good documentation for people to follow. And that's everything from, here's an alert, here's how we need to triage this alert, here are the points of escalation if we see problems, here's where we feel like it's safe to close out this alert with no further actions. And those type of things, we have to make those clear for other people. And honestly, if you spend some time putting together the good documentation, hopefully they don't have to ask. People can find that on their own and just automatically walk through the steps. Even if they still reach out and say, hey, look, I'm seeing this. What should I do? Well, here, check out this documentation that's been written for this exact alert. And then let us know if there's something that doesn't fit or if there's questions, that sort of thing. So that upfront time you spend collecting screenshots and marking them up, and it's all work and tedious effort, but it absolutely pays dividends. So that's another function of what we do. I work at a place that we do some community engagement stuff as well. They tend to tap me for some of those opportunities when they arise. So I'm always happy to do those sort of things. And then some of the other job responsibilities, we have what are attack surface focus groups within the organization. And those are cross team. It's not just everybody from this one team doing this. It's people from teams all over the company.
So when you say attack surface focus groups, are you looking at how other teams work in the organization and kind of the processes associated with technology as well? Or how do those conversations occur?
Yeah, so these are recurring meetings,
okay,
about once a week, half an hour. And essentially,
whoever the captain and co-captain of this group are, they determine what the topics are going to be. But of course, you have open questions and answer sessions. But it's a great way to get everybody together and cross-collaborating. That pays more dividends than people probably realize, because when you have a particular situation, if you know people in other teams by name and how to get a hold of them, and you've established that rapport and that relationship, you know who to reach out to right away. And since they likewise have familiarity with you, they're going to be usually very helpful. And so the attack surfaces are things like network attacks, social engineering attacks, endpoint security, and on, supply chain.
Yeah.
AI wouldn't be a security conference if we didn't at least mention AI.
Right.
But there's a few others, but that's just to give you an idea of the groups that are brought in. And it's not just technical people that are part of these groups in every situation. For example, in social engineering focus group, that was the first one. They asked me to spearhead it because I have a lot of experience running things like that. And so that's what I did. And so, for example, we had corporate legal counsel on that, because things that come up are, look, there's some impersonations on social media for some VIPs in our organization, and we need to get this stuff taken down. And again, having that contact and then knowing who you are when you reach out in advance, they understand what your motivation is and what they're trying to prevent. And those are just those opportunities that come about. That's just one real quick example that, you know, we could talk about that all day.
No, what I love about that kind of outreach is, I know looking at security in some organizations, if you're not actively involved with throughout your organization, then when people only get the call and bad things happen, they're not looking forward to that conversation. And you don't get the same collaboration, right? You're like, oh, security's bothering me again. They want me to go look at something, or they're whatever. But when you have that ongoing conversation and you know who you're talking to and they know you, where you wouldn't be asking unless you really needed to be asking something, right? You kind of get a better response and reaction. And I think that's great how you've kind of built that culture, right, into that whole process. So, and the other thing that you mentioned that I really liked, when you talk about being kind of a life learner, there's an analogy that I talked with Rob Lee, not the one with the beard from Sands, but the bald one from Sands. And he made the analogy of, you know, his daughter, I think, was going to medical school, and she was studying for, you know, her degree for that, and the stack of books that she had. And he's like, yeah, he goes, I compared her stack of books to the stack of books I have, and my stack was bigger, but she gets a PhD, and some of us don't even have degrees, and we just have certifications. And it's just like that, there's just that much going on in the field that I feel like you're right. You have to stay pretty active to what's new, but also what are like some best practices, because some things just change over time. I'm sure you can probably speak to how, you know, you did security or thought about security 20 years ago to today. There's probably a lot that's different, right? So speaking of that, you know, one of the things I saw as far as your activity, you do a lot of activity just within the cyber community, right? You've talked and interact with different groups. So what is it, your big takeaways when you get to have these opportunities and talk with, you know, diverse groups of people from all over the field, especially on some key speaking points? Walk through a little bit of that experience, your big takeaways from that, and what you like doing about that.
Yeah, that's just been a great experience overall. And I really enjoy the opportunity to engage with people and talk about this stuff. I get asked an awful lot of questions as somebody that speaks a lot of things. So it forces you to think through things. But one thing that's still true today, and it's been true for a long time, is if you want to get really good at something, teach it to other people.
Yeah.
Because honestly, that forces you to learn it at a subject matter expertise level intelligently enough to be able to explain it to other people. And honestly, I've kind of purposely done that on a few examples. For example, I have a digital forensics talk and my PowerShell skills get rusty after a while. And I thought, I really need to step this up. And so I incorporated discussing PowerShell topics in this digital forensics talk. And sure enough, my PowerShell skills improved giving this talk because I started playing around a little bit more.
Right.
And so you can kind of use those things to push or motivate yourself, because, you know,
lifelong learner and all that, you're always going to have way more things that you want to learn and spend time in than you'll ever actually have time to do. So you have to try to prioritize what those things are going to be, and whatever you can do to motivate yourself to, you know, focus on those priorities.
Yeah,
and
hey, engagement is a great driver.
Oh yeah. And if you can have fun along the way and communicate with other people and see their reactions and then have additional conversations. And I've given some talks where I got such great questions from the audience. For example, I would go back in the next time I would give that talk, maybe somewhere else, I would bake it into the presentation to discuss, because it was such a great topic that would come up. So much of my content probably stays pretty static, but once in a while there's that gem out there that's great. I absolutely should put that in here. And those things definitely come about through that engagement. The other thing, it's not just during the conference, it's also what people call LobbyCon, just being able to socialize with other people and learn about what they do and what they're working on and their research projects. And I've talked to some amazing, brilliant people and have learned a ton from them, and particularly speakers at conferences.
Yeah.
If you sit in on a talk, maybe it's not the best place to ask every question, but if you have a question, you can always hit up that speaker later on and ask or have a conversation. And I've made really good friendships doing that and learned a lot from other people doing that. It's really helpful. And one of the things I always try to encourage folks, and it's really hard for aspiring cybersecurity professionals to get them motivated, go out there and professionally network.
Right.
But they really should, for a variety of reasons. That's one of them. But also, it's a lot easier if somebody knows who you are and say, hey, you know, here are my skills and here's this position I was thinking of applying for it. What do you think? If they feel like you're ready, they'll say, yeah, you should apply for that. And then they will be the person telling human resources, hey, I know this person a little bit. I think they might be a good fit. We'd like to talk to them at least and interview them.
Yeah, so like, I like how, you know, when you talk about, I mean, you're a speaker, but you talk about interacting with other speakers. One of the things I do like and appreciate is cybersecurity can be very intimidating, especially when you're new to it, right? Because there's just so much to know, and you see these experts that you almost can idolize as far as what they're able to do at that point in their career. But the one thing I've always loved, and you kind of express it here, is, you know, people in the field are always very receptive to questions and interactions, regardless of what level. You see people that are CIOs and CISOs out there giving talks, but they'll talk to pretty much anybody that just has the intrigue or curiosity within the field. And I think that's awesome. So one of the things that I'm curious about, based on your experience and kind of what you think about and what you see from trending's perspectives, is there something in cybersecurity that is kind of on the fringe of like something that keeps you up at night, or something that you think that, you know, you actively are trying to address, or, you know, a key risk that people should be at least thinking about from your perspective and experience?
Yeah, I think some of the things that always concern me are maybe a certain alert type.
Okay.
And it's throwing so many alerts that are very noisy, and maybe things, you know, get looked at, but you get concerned because after analysts have seen the same alert fire hundreds of times and there's never been anything significant required, are we going to miss that Raspberry Pi that's popping reverse shells somewhere that somebody plugged into the network and found a way to do that? Did somebody pwn the printer and now they're pivoting their attacks through there? Are we going to miss these kinds of things because we have this alert fatigue? That's one thing that I definitely am always concerned with, and always happy to work with detection engineers to try to figure those things out. Always happy to work with threat hunting groups as well to figure out maybe this might be worth checking in the environment sort of situation.
Right.
So I think the other thing is just assets management is also really hard. If you've ever talked to anybody, it feels like they understand every single asset within an enterprise with no exceptions. They might be the first. I would hope they're the first.
Right.
And so the thing is, if you don't have visibility, it's awful hard to protect what you don't know is there.
So you have these blind spots, these gaps, these visibilities, and then some of the other things when mergers and acquisitions of startups, and you start to slowly onboard them, but they don't have the mature security model that your organization has, for example, but it's the mindsets of the people working there, because small startup, people have to wear a lot of different hats, and it's just whatever it takes to get the job done.
Right.
And sometimes it's hard to get that mentality out of a startup that was brought into another organization through merger or acquisition. And so those things are always concerning. You know, are they, for example, spinning up, you know, sub-hosts or host records that go to the cloud for a temporary project, and then do those DNS records get purged when the project is done? Because if they don't, and an actor finds that and it's not actively in use, guess what? They can sign up for an account in that cloud service, and if they have to end up on the right host or IP address, whatever, now they can impersonate. And it's people doing things that you, visibility is one thing that definitely concerns me. And then retention. How long do we have the information we need? So if we have to look at something that may have happened 6 months, 9 months ago, can we do that? How hard and difficult is that? What do we lose at over time? Right. And what specifically do we lose at certain points?
From your incident response experience, what's the furthest back you've had to look to validate something that you can recall?
That's a good question. I think we've had things that happened of interest potentially a year ago.
Okay.
I can't think of too many situations where we've needed to get whatever we could, and often very limited, more than a year ago.
Right.
Now, that's not an excuse not to retain things. If you have a legal obligation or a compliance obligation to retain certain records for a certain amount of time, you definitely, again, should talk to your compliance people, your legal people, those sort of things, to make sure that you're within those guidelines. But it's also, it can be a bit of a balancing act, because, for example, if you don't ever purge old emails out of a system, everything there is subject to being subpoenaed.
Right.
And so that could be things that maybe don't paint an organization in a particularly good
light. How do you protect yourself in both capacities, right?
Yeah.
You purge versus what you don't.
Right. Yeah, it's a difficult balancing act. But I think any time that you get further out than 30 days, it usually starts getting a little bit more difficult, particularly if you're going back from to a certain point in time. Like, let's say this may have happened as far back as 8 months ago. We just saw this
right
the last couple days. You have to cover that whole time span. And when you have to scale, those simple investigations become much more complex. Your tools don't work as effective if you're trying to do one search in your SIM platform, for example. It's like trying to boil the ocean,
right,
when you're trying to
go back that far.
Go back that far to current.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm a huge data junkie when it comes to just data in general. I love trying to solve problems with data, figure out how to come up with new solutions by using data. So visibility goes a long way with me. With you talked about some of your concerns, because I mean, when you look at like the CIS controls, those are some of the top things, just knowing what you're defending, and then kind of leads into visibility. And I think it gets harder today with how organizations are structuring, because not everything is necessarily on-prem anymore. Now you have things in other areas that people haven't really solved or provided the same visibility that you might have seen traditionally, right? So you have to either get creative or be proactive in trying to solve some of those problems. So I think those are great points that you brought up. But any lasting remarks do you want to leave to the audience as far as what you want to leave them with or leave them thinking about before we kind of close this out?
I think the biggest thing is, if you're in this space and you're either trying to break in or you're just starting off, find a mentor, find a quality mentor, and learn from them. I talk to a lot of people that would do well to talk to somebody in the field before they apply for a job and go on an interview, for example. I think that's a big thing. And I'm huge on professional networking. It really helps in getting to know people that do different things. So when you need those subject matter expertises, do that. So I, as much as I encourage it, very seldom do I see people that actually go out and do it. But the ones I do tend to be the ones that ultimately prove out to have the most success in their careers.
That's good advice. Well, Matt, I appreciate your time. I appreciate you talking with us. For all those folks that are listening, I hope you enjoyed this and happy hunting.